Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's Africa Link program this Thursday, the 9th of August. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are coming to you live from our studios in Bonn, Germany.
And we are live on Facebook, DW Africa. Now, coming up in the program, the DR Congo's Election Commission has closed registration for political candidates ahead of the elections in December.
I have a patriotic message to the president of the Electoral Commission, CENI. If he does not want the country to go down into war again, then he must organize credible and transparent elections.
In turmoil in Zimbabwe, as opposition MDC politician Tendai Biti appears in court in Harare after a failed request for an asylum in Zambia.
We all assumed that Zimbabwe would be now different from the Zimbabwe of Mugabe's, and that elections would be free and fair, that there would be no arbitrary arrests. We thought these were a thing of the past.
And three Palestinians are killed, including a pregnant woman and a child. Israel says it was in retaliation for rockets and mortars fired from Gaza. These are some of the stories that we've lined up for you.
But first, let's listen to some of the stories that are making headlines around the world.
I'm Zipporah Nyambura with the DW News. Senior Zimbabwean opposition figure Tendai Biti was in police custody on Thursday after Zambia rejected his asylum bid and deported him. Biti had fled to the neighbouring country after Zimbabwean police indicated that they wanted to question him over post-election violence that left six people dead. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, has condemned Zambia's refusal to offer Biti asylum. Spokesman Baba Baloch made this statement.
UNHCR remains gravely concerned about the reported incident of a Zimbabwean asylum seeker who was seeking safety in Zambia, forcibly returning refugees and asylum seekers to a place where their life is in danger is a violation of the international refugee law.
Latest reports indicate he has been charged with inciting violence. His arrest has also raised more fears about a government crackdown on political opponents following the July 30 election. Russia says sanctions which the United States plans to impose later this month are unacceptable. The Trump administration says it has determined that Russia used a nerve agent to poison former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Britain in March. Moscow has always denied involvement in the double poisoning. Maria Zakharova is a Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman.
All these allegations are baseless and cynical. Russia has warned multiple times that using force and using ultimatums when talking with us is futile. Russia is going to develop a response to this very hostile step on the part of Washington.
The sanctions will target exports of sensitive electronic components and other technologies. Three people have been killed in Gaza as Israel carried out dozens of airstrikes in response to some 180 rockets and mortars fired at its territory by militants. Fireballs and explosions began on Wednesday night into Thursday, forcing residents to scramble to bomb shelters. Gaza health officials said a pregnant woman and her daughter, aged one, were among those killed. The violence comes as the UN and Egypt try to broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, which dominates Gaza. South Sudan's president has granted amnesty to opposition leader Riek Machar and all rebel groups days after signing a power-sharing deal. Under the deal, Kiir will remain president and Machar will return to the country as the first of five vice presidents. Welcoming the move, General Nathaniel Oyet, a top official of SPLM in opposition, maintained they want to see several political detainees released, including their former spokesman James Gatet, who was sentenced to death by Salva Kiir's regime.
We take it as a change in attitude, but we want this to be accompanied by the release of all political detainees, the release of the prisoners of war, or anyone who is detained in connection with the conflict. We'll only believe that there is a change in attitude if we see all these Sudanese who are currently under detention of the regime go free unconditionally.
For more news, visit our website at dw.com/Africa. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
You are listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Wanjiko Mora.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. As usual, we are broadcasting live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. We already have lots of responses there from you guys.
Yes, I see Taya Nicole here who says, I'm glad to hear this, the news that have just passed. We see you. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we begin the program in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where President Joseph Kabila ended months of speculation by backing former Interior Minister Emmanuel Ramazani Shadary to be his successor in the upcoming election.
Now, Shadary will face opposition figure Felix Tshisekedi and most probably Jean-Pierre Bemba, who had been in prison at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, since another of Kabila's rivals, Moise Katumbi, was not able to submit his application. Will Bemba also be disqualified? Eddie Micah Jr. has more.
The DRC's Electoral Commission has begun checking the candidates' documents for approval after Wednesday's deadline for all aspirants to submit their candidacy. Opposition figure Felix Tshisekedi submitted his application, but him and his supporters clashed with the police during their rally. Fistin Mbuyo is chairman of Tshisekedi's USPD party.
I have a patriotic message to the president of the Electoral Commission, CENI. If he does not want the country to go down into war again, then he must organize credible and transparent elections. Only that will give us peace. If he prefers to either collaborate or even manipulate so that the candidate of the majority party wins the government, then there will be violence and he will be responsible for the blood that is shed.
But the opposition candidate most likely to shake up Kabila's power clique, Jean-Pierre Bemba, was unable to submit a valid voting card when submitting his candidacy. He missed the deadline to obtain a voting card as he was being held in prison at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Another of Kabila's rivals, Moise Katumbi, was not even allowed into the country. The former governor of the mineral-rich province of Katanga, who has been in self-imposed exile since 2016, was denied permission to cross the border into DRC due to a pending lawsuit. Some experts fear that these elections could lead to a new war if none of the top three candidates qualify to contest in the polls. Political scientist Pamphile Ngoma says the current signs are alarming, especially considering that Kabila pushed through army reforms just a few weeks ago.
He reformed the army and as a result gave new posts to new generals who now want to stay in power and do not want to seal the end of a regime. So there is the possibility of a new military front. They will incite the militias to move against the government. And Kabila will say, I am your military leader, we are at war, and it's all a maneuver to stay in power.
Ngoma believes these generals could incite the many militias roaming throughout the war torn east to spark a rebellion and that Kabila could be put in charge as a supreme military leader.
Eddie Micah Jr. with that report. And the U.S. Department of State has already congratulated Joseph Kabila for not seeking a third term.
And with that thought, we go to our Facebook where we asked you, let's imagine a DR Congo without Kabila. Will it get better? And we've been receiving your comments here.
And I have one from Emmanuel Hitilasha says, the problem in Congo is the West, who are hell-bent to steal coltan and cobalt and every valuable mineral found on the face of earth. That's in Congo.
And Trevor Mwamba says they have to have a man who will be favorable to them in terms of trade opportunities, etc., or Western. Secondly, he adds, the African leaders themselves are not in politics to help the people, but are in there for themselves.
Hubertson says Congo is a whole country. You should know that staying in power like African presidents do is not a right thing, and don't take it for normal.
And just to remind you, on Facebook page, we are actually having a debate. I see Ty Nicole responding to Terumun Ayua. We shall be getting to that a little later. But first, to international news. The Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli airstrikes have killed a pregnant 23-year-old woman and her 18-month-old daughter in the Gaza Strip. One Hamas fighter was also killed. The Israeli army launched the attacks after Hamas militants fired more than 180 rockets into Israel, injuring at least three Israelis.
Now, the security situation in the region has been tense since March, when Palestinians began staging weekly protests along the Israel-Gaza border. Israel has warned Hamas against further escalation. DW's Tanya Kremer has more from Gaza.
Well, the situation seems to have quieted down in the past hour or so, but it's not yet clear where this is going. We've seen such escalations in the past month or so already several times, and both sides always say they don't have an interest to take it any further, but I think only the next hours will tell. According to the Israeli army, about 180 projectiles were fired from Gaza into southern Israel. About 30 of them were intercepted by the Israeli defense system, Iron Dome. And the Israeli army says they have targeted over 150 sites and locations in the Gaza Strip since yesterday. Three people there in the Gaza Strip were killed, according to health officials there, and people on both sides were injured.
That was Tanya Kremer. Now, back to the African continent, a senior Zimbabwean opposition figure, Tendai Biti, is in police custody after Zambia rejected his asylum bid and deported him back to the capital, Harare. He appeared in court in Harare and was charged with inciting public violence and declaring unofficial or fake election results.
Now, if Tendai Biti is convicted, he could spend up to a decade in prison. Biti's plight has raised concerns that President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who narrowly won the first election after the fall of Robert Mugabe, will treat the opposition just as harshly as before, despite promises of reforms. Wilf Mbanga, who is the publisher of the newspaper The Zimbabwean, has been telling me more.
Well, the whole thing is very sad. But, you know, elections that were meant to be free, fair and transparent have turned out like this, with litigation and with people being harassed and killed and others fleeing the country and so on. That is not the way elections should be held.
Do you think that Zimbabweans have been hoping to have put this whole history behind them?
Indeed, when Mugabe fell last November, and we were assured that, you know, this is now a new dispensation with a different way of doing things, we all assumed that, you know, Zimbabwe would be now different from the Zimbabwe of Mugabe's, and that elections will be free and fair, that there will be no arbitrary arrests, no beating up of people, you know, extrajudicial killings and so on. We thought these were a thing of the past.
Now, on the political front, former finance minister and a very popular opposition politician, Tendai Biti, is in trouble in Harare. He's been seeking asylum in neighboring Zambia. Why do you think he fled?
Well, he fled because he was being harassed. You might be aware that a few days ago, his car was shot at. Somebody was following him and shot at his car. And bullets were also found outside his house. He felt unsafe in Zimbabwe. You might also remember Vice President and now President Emmerson Mnangagwa fled Zimbabwe when he was sacked from government. He also felt unsafe at the, you know, at the time. So it is a fact that in Zimbabwe, life is cheap.
Do you think that this current government might be behind it? Or would you say it's the same people at the army who still control much of Zimbabwe?
Well, who knows? You know, until they are caught, we have no idea.
But why are they targeting Tendai Biti when the person that if someone has to target would be opposition leader Nelson Chamisa?
Well, they're saying, you know, Tendai Biti announced the results of the elections before ZEC had done so, which is an offence in Zimbabwe.
But Chamisa also made that statement even before the official result came out.
Yes, well, he's one of the eight people that the police are interested in interviewing. So they will be either arresting him or taking him in for questioning.
Wilf Mbanga, publisher of The Zimbabwean.
And just to remind you, go over to our Facebook page, DW Africa. We have an eye on that and we'll be back right after this.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to DW's Africa Link. I am Abubakar Jalo.
And I am Wanjiko Mwaura. And we are broadcasting live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. I see Prince Bin Frunche has joined us. Welcome. And remember to share so that we can have, again, more people listening. We would love to hear your thoughts on the stories that we have on the show. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, the plight of young Somalis in the small British town of Bristol.
For a long time, I never used to wear hijab. I was normal, like anybody else. And a lot of people didn't even know I was a Muslim. But after the conversation, and then Trump came in, and there was a whole Muslim thing, I thought, okay, now I need to be counted, and I want to be a Muslim visibly.
And why are women shunned in Kenya? Because they are unable to bear children.
We will hear all that a little bit later. But first, one of nine candidates to run for the October 7th presidential election in Cameroon is Akere Muna, a lawyer and former vice president of Transparency International. He says he believes he will be able to beat the incumbent Paul Biya because Cameroonians are fed up with corruption that has characterized Biya's 36-year-old reign.
Moki Kinseka interviewed Akere Muna, who is also one of the most influential Cameroonians, on his ambitions and visions at a time his country's notoriously divided opposition can't produce a single candidate to challenge Biya. Muna starts by stating why he is the best candidate.
I know what irks this country. I know the misery they are in. I know what's happening in the north and southwest because I'm from there. When I came back home from the Bar of England, my file turned the Minister of Justice because we're looking for the equivalence of a barrister at law degree. So I know exactly what it is to be an Anglophone in this country. But I'm saying that we don't want to change the country. We want to change the government. And that's my message. And no Cameroonian loves living in misery. I think I know that. We have a huge governance problem linked to corruption and all that goes with it. And I've done only that for the past 25 years.
You talk about corruption and you want to be president. If the system stays in place, how would you be president? With corruption and with the issues you're talking about here?
Under my government, there will be zero tolerance for corruption. Absolutely zero tolerance. This country is tailor-made for any kind of corrupt practice. It's tailor-made. Any sector. The solutions are there, but we don't use them. World Bank report on public expenses of 18th May says so. Procurement, prices bloated. Meetings, prices bloated for meetings and per diems. Missions, travel, days increase, prices bloated. Every single way they have to spend money, they increase it by prices. And the report says Cameroonian civil servants don't live off their salary. They live from a system where they have put toll gates everywhere and they collect money. It's not me, it's the World Bank. So we have a corrupt system that must be fixed. It must be fixed.
And my question is, how would you get there? Because the system is corrupt and well implanted.
Well implanted, because those who are the system of fighting corruption of this government is expecting the fish to fry themselves. It doesn't work. You cannot get people who are thieves to look over thieves. It's as easy as that. Nothing shocks Cameroons anymore. We have been zombified. Cameroonians hear that they arrest the minister and he produces $1.7 billion CFA. Nobody scandalizes. They show sort of amazing pictures on the web of sumptuous ceremonies and buildings. Everybody says, we have all been zombified to the point where we are numb. We think everything is normal. Even the saddest fact, not every Cameroonian has a fair chance. And government action should be to serve Cameroonians, not to punish them, not to allow them to languish in misery. It doesn't work. Come on, man. We have a country where the poor and the weak don't stand a chance. And that's not fair. It's not African.
Barrister?
Yeah.
In 30 seconds, your mission, vision, and objective. What are you promising Cameroonians if you get to achieve?
The government action must have the interest of the people at the heart of it. So in this country, we must have justice for all, health for all, and education for all. That way, you know you take care of the poorest.
Akere Muna, presidential hopeful in Cameroon, speaking to DW's Moki Edwin. We have a quick response here from Gala Jefferson, who says, I don't even know a single Anglophone that cares so much about these so-called elections.
Well, and that takes us to our next report.
News On.
The UK is home to the largest Somali community in Europe since the 1990s, when war, conflict and unrest wreaked havoc in the country. Despite being one of the fastest growing ethnic communities in Bristol in the UK, they haven't always been so visible in that city.
Now, in 2017, Bristol Museums and the M-Shed held an exhibition showcasing the stories of young Somalis in the city. Their stories are now being digitalized online and have helped the dialogue between the Somali community and the rest of the Bristol population. Emma Wallace has more.
My name is Mohammed Jama Hassan. I'm originally from Somalia, born in Somalia.
Sitting on a park bench on a sunny day, Mohammed tells me how he juggles several identities at once.
I usually identify as Somali because that's what I grew up with, and that's the main identity that was had a lot of influence in my life. At the moment, I'm a British citizen, and I've been British since 2007.
That's partly why the M-Shed Museum in Bristol decided to put on an exhibition documenting various members of the Somali community and their stories. The museum curator was Finn White.
The words that kept coming up when people were trying to identify Somaliness, it was togetherness, it was community, it was supporting each other. And I think that must help fuel that togetherness.
Sometimes, though, that togetherness has tended to isolate the community. The two-way integration that Bristol authorities are aiming for can sometimes be misunderstood, explains Abdi Mohammed, a director of the Somali Media Group, who also took part in the exhibition.
Integration, what does that mean to us? Is it in terms of culture? Is it in terms of people take as assimilation, which sometimes is very difficult. But for me, is are we contributing? Yes, regardless to our background, to our culture, are we contributing to the success of the communities that we live? Are we contributing to the success of the country, the society, both socially and economically? And that is what matters. Integration, that is integration to me.
The problems of integration can be further complicated by the use of labels. In the UK, Somalis are often just part of the Black and Minority Ethnic, BME, community.
Hello, good afternoon, Black Southwest Network. Can I help you?
Sado Jirda is the director of the Black Southwest Network in Bristol, which works for race equality. She's an ethnic Somali who grew up in Kenya and then the UK.
I guess naturally, when we tend to look at the Black community or the BME community, we see them as a homogeneous group, and that's not the case. They might be Black, but even the context of African, culturally they're very different, religiously very different.
For the Somali community, things are further complicated by the labels people in the West tend to associate with Islam. Sado herself took up wearing the hijab post-Brexit.
For a long time, I never used to wear hijab. I was normal, like anybody else. And a lot of people didn't even know I was a Muslim. But after the conversation, and then Trump came in, and there was a whole Muslim thing, I thought, OK, now I need to be counted, and I want to be a Muslim visibly. And if somebody is annoyed by that, so be it.
Abdi Mohammed has his office in the east of Bristol, just around the corner from streets filled with Somali businesses. He thinks the key to the future is all about understanding the social, cultural and economic wealth that the Somali community can bring to Bristol.
Once we realise that, how can we take advantage of the social and cultural capital they bring with them, then you will understand how resilient these communities are. We just say, look how far I come. Hindustan, Pakistan, to London, to
a galaxy far from their ignorance. Cause immigrants, we get the job done. For DW, this is Emma Wallace in Bristol in the southwest of England.
I hope you have enjoyed listening to what young Somalis are going through in the UK. Now, over to our Facebook page. We have a comment here from Solomon Acha Kofi, who says, anyone that wins the presidential election in Cameroon will dissolve Parliament and the Senate. What are your thoughts? Remember to write in to us on DW Africa Facebook page.
Speaking out.
Now, in many parts of Africa, children are perceived as a sign of prosperity. The more you have, the richer you are. And it's not only about a monetary wealth, no. And Kenya is no exception. In some communities, couples without children are being made to feel there is no greater shame than that of a woman who cannot bear children.
Infertile women are ridiculed and shunned or accused of being coerced. As DW's Andrew Asike reports, often the women themselves believe the reason they cannot give birth is due to witchcraft.
In many parts of Kenya, churches are perpetuating these mistaken beliefs and standing in the way of efforts to raise awareness about the causes of infertility, prevention and treatment. Evangelist James Nganga is known for staging scenarios that have provoked scandals. Today, he tells his followers he is speaking to a demon who was sent to Miriam Kalovi by a childhood friend to cause infertility. Nganga says it is not actually Miriam speaking, but the demon.
I was just sent to cause infertility to this woman, and I have been here for a long time. We robbed her of the ability to give birth. We locked her ability to give birth. Yes, we came and did that.
Receive your miracle back. I set the lady free.
In the audience, childless women drift away. Some have treatable or preventable medical conditions that lead to infertility, but are unaware that medical professionals can help. Often, childlessness is blamed only on the women, who in turn end up facing discrimination. Anne, who has never had a child, tells me about her misery.
The minute you get married, so the next expectation is to have a child. 9 months, there was none. 1 year, none. Second year, none. That dear man, the pain you go when you don't have that child, nobody can feel it. It's only you. I'm a pastor, sorry to say. Some of them will even insist they want to sleep with you so that you can conceive.
In communities such as the Abakuri and the Nandi people, women are assigned to work in their farms their whole lives with no education. They never consider seeking help from health professionals. If no child is born 2 years into marriage, traditional practices step in. The childless woman is forced to marry another woman to sire children for her through her husband in order to satisfy a cultural demand. The community calls this Nyumba Mboke. It is the only acceptable woman-to-woman marriage in Kenya. Well, is infertility a curse? Dr. V. Rajini is a renowned obstetrician and gynecologist and answers this.
It is a very sad belief that many have. Most of the people blame the sins of the previous birth or the curse of the god which is responsible for the infertility.
Dr. Alfred Murage is a fertility consultant in Kenya. He says that infertility affects one in every six couples. He lists possible causes that could affect the fertility of both men and women.
In our setup, mostly it's sexual infections, which brings in issues with the fallopian tubes in terms of transporting an egg. And then for men, you can get blockage of the sperm transport channels and damage to the testes.
So, infertility is not a curse, but are most cases of infertility treatable? Murage again.
Well, it's quite a fairly common thing, and normally would say about one in every six couples, but thankfully majority of them can be helped to conceive. The thing that needs to be done is for them to be assessed, both the man and the woman together.
In childless marriages, women often bear the stigma alone. The only way to break the discrimination they face is by raising awareness about infertility, treatment and prevention. This is through sexual and reproductive health education across Kenya.
Andrew Wasike with that report from Nairobi. And it's been a pleasure having you aboard. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
And my name is Wanjiko Mwaura. Thank you so much for joining us on Facebook Live. Thank you so much for sharing. We will be with you very, very soon. And just before we go, one last comment from Etamba who says it's heartbreaking that well-to-do Cameroonians know the plight but do nothing. Until next time, goodbye.